Proverbs 11:24-28. Give freely and become more wealthy. Be stingy and lose everything. The generous will prosper. Those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed. People curse those who hoard their grain, but they bless the one who sells in time of need. If you search for good, you will find favor. But if you search for evil, it will find you. Trust in your money and down you go. But the godly flourish like leaves in the spring. 13:11. Wealth from get-rich-quick schemes quickly disappears. Wealth from hard work grows over time. 21:5-6+20. Good planning and hard work lead to prosperity, but hasty shortcuts lead to poverty. Wealth created by a lying tongue is a vanishing mist and a deadly trap. The wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get. 30:7-9. Oh God, I beg two favors from you. Let me have them before I die. First, help me to never tell a lie. Second, give me neither poverty nor riches. Give me just enough to satisfy my needs. For if I grow rich, I may deny you and say, who is the Lord? And if I am too poor, I may steal and thus insult God's holy name. This is God's word.
And now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. So thank you, Cassie, for reading our scripture this evening. As Andy sort of prefaced, I am Garrett Haas. I'm one of the elders here at Mission. And my role this evening is to continue really to engage us in this time of worship by unpacking the scripture this evening and to talk about this really important concept of money as we see it in the Proverbs. So, as the passages probably already gave away, and Andy also spoiled, this week is the money week in our Proverbs sermon series. And for those of you who have been around a while, you are not surprised to see Garrett up here for this topic. It's probably one of the main things that folks know about me. Wears Hawaiian shirts and likes to help people with personal finances. And since I'm still waiting for the Wisdom in Apparel week, I'm grateful to be up here to take us through this topic, which is one that can often feel pervasive in our life and yet also a substantial source of frustration or even shame. Now, before we fully jump in, I want to give everyone a short reminder of the sermon series that we're in and what we're doing this year. So this year, we have been working our way through wisdom literature with an emphasis on the Proverbs. And as Andy introduced at the start of the year, Proverbs are always to be thought of like hard candy. They are this sweet treat that is meant to be mulled over, to be slowly considered over time and through many sort of rotations, right? It is, if you try to bite into it, it will, in fact, be not the experience that it was intended for. And Proverbs are much the same way. And perhaps no more so than with money. So over the past month, as I started to think about this sermon, I was paying extra close attention to what and how the various topics in Proverbs were being addressed and how I might apply that to my own sermon. And what started to really stand out to me was that this money thing is everywhere in the Proverbs. Like each week, the topic was supposedly on something totally else. And yet, at least one, if not multiple of the verses were directly addressing the topic of money or wealth in some way. And to sort of demonstrate my point, I want to actually read some of the key passages that we've used in recent weeks. So listen in. From August 2nd, when we were talking about discipline and pleasure, here are some of the passages. 21:16-17. The person who strays from common sense will end up in the company of the dead. Those who love pleasure become poor, and those who love wine and luxury will never be rich. 23:20. Do not carouse with drunkards or feast with gluttons, for they are on their way to poverty, and too much sleep clothes them in rags. Then from August 9th, when the topic was truth and misinformation, Listen to these passages. Proverbs 18:10 and 11. The name of the Lord is a strong fortress. The godly run to him and are safe. The rich think of their wealth as a strong defense. They imagine it to be a high wall of safety. And Proverbs 19:1 to 4. Better to be poor and honest than to be dishonest and a fool. Enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. Haste makes mistakes. People ruin their lives by their own foolishness and then are angry at God. Wealth makes many friends. Poverty drives them all away. And finally, last week, when we were discussing hard conversations, we had this. Proverbs 25:11 to 12. Timely advice is lovely, like golden apples in a silver basket. To one who listens, valid criticism is like a gold earring or other gold jewelry. So these are just really the examples that stood out from the past 3 weeks' verses. And in many of them, they're directly talking about wealth or money. And some of them, they are referencing it indirectly by comparing some worthwhile trait to a gold or silver object. It's easy to see that Proverbs as a whole spends a lot of time talking about wealth and poverty and the various causes and outcomes of each. But now, before we get further into the sermon, I actually want to give folks a chance to reflect on some of their own current behaviors and beliefs around money. So to that effect, there's a little three-question survey, which, to be clear, we're not collecting or anything. This is going to be used as a tool for self-reflection that we're going to do now. There's a piece of paper in the pocket of the chair in front of you, and you should hopefully find both a paper and a pen. There's definitely a good amount of folks here today, so some folks might have to grab the chair behind them or you know, distribute it around. Though we also have it, yes, up on the screen for anyone watching along at home. So yeah, I want you to take a moment, circle the options that you feel best fit your current agreement or disagreement with the statements. And if you are someone who is visiting us today or do not call mission at your home church, then for question two, just sort of mentally fill in what you would answer for your home church. All right. If you've answered, I also want you to take a minute to reflect on why you've selected the items you have. Is there something specific that pushes your answer one way or another? Are you not even sure how to answer one of the questions? All right. Hopefully that's given you a moment to think about where you're at with money. And the questions themselves likely give you some idea about where we're going tonight. We'll start by trying to identify what Proverbs might be telling us about why finances can be so hard to talk about or to talk about in the right way and the right times. Then we'll discuss what you can do with money, focusing on the categories of spending, saving, and giving. And finally, we'll try to get at the heart of, but whose money is it anyway? As I noted at the top, this is a topic that I'm very interested in, and so I could talk way, way longer than we have time for this evening. And therefore, I found preparation to be somewhat uniquely challenging, especially trying to understand what to include versus exclude. The result of this process, though, is that there will be some moments of real practicality mixed into the broader concepts. I hope I've struck the right balance there, but feel free to talk to me afterwards if there's anything you want to discuss further. Again, these are conversations that I enjoy. So, as I was prepping, one of the things that stood out to me is the mismatch between how much money affects our lives and how much time we spend discussing it with one another. Like, money impacts our housing, transportation, eating habits, health, and nearly everything else in our lives in some way. And has anyone here had the experience of just trying to figure out hangout plans with friends when, the only time that works for folks is right around dinner time on a Monday? So what are you going to do for dinner? And now the question of money has been brought up, because who's going to pay for that dinner? Is one person going to supply it? Are you all going to just get what you can before? Maybe you're going to split a meal out. But what about your one friend who was laid off last month and just found a new job? Are they going to be okay with that distribution? This seemingly simple, unrelated plan quickly devolves into a financial and logistical mess. And note how much more complicated this becomes when friends aren't actually familiar with each other's financial situation and are mostly just having to guess at what would be comfortable for someone else. So as I thought about this notion of the pervasiveness of money, I had the idea to look back at a couple months of my own bank statements, and it turns out that since the start of June, I was only able to find 3 days without some kind of transaction. There's literally something always happening. So despite the fact that finances are intersecting with some part of my life nearly daily, I'm pretty sure that if I have an honest finance-related conversation with someone even once a week for a few weeks in a row, it will start to stand out to me. And I feel like I talk about it more than most. So, to try and break out of this typical lack of discussion, in the weeks leading up to this sermon, I asked a few of our church members about what they might want to hear from a sermon about money. And two of the elements of feedback that stood out were this. Oh, that's interesting. I don't think I've heard a sermon about money before. I mean, maybe about tithing, but beyond that, I don't remember any. So anything would be pretty interesting. And, oh boy, that's a tough one. Like, what do you even say about money? It can feel evil, even if I know it's not. I hate it when I don't have it, and I hate it when I have too much. So, money is everywhere, affecting nearly every part of our lives, and yet we talk about it with one another almost never. Let's contrast that with what Proverbs is doing. While we struggle to talk about money, and such conversations can easily become awkward, Proverbs brings it up often and in many contexts. We already heard a handful of passages right at the start, and I pointed out how many passages from the last few weeks also reference the topic. But I want to read back through, adding in some extra verses that kind of got cut for time, to continue highlighting what I was seeing. Starting with Proverbs 6, 1-5. My child, if you have put up security for a friend's debt or agreed to guarantee the debt of a stranger, if you have trapped yourself by your agreement and are caught by what you said, follow my advice and save yourself, for you have placed yourself at your friend's mercy. Now, swallow your pride. Go and beg to have your name erased. Don't put it off. Do it now. Don't rest until you do. Save yourself like a gazelle escaping from a hunter, like a bird fleeing from a net. In Proverbs 10, lazy people are soon poor. Hard workers get rich. A wise youth harvests in the summer, but one who sleeps during harvest is a disgrace. Proverbs 11, 24-28. Give freely and become more wealthy. Be stingy and lose everything. The generous will prosper. Those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed. People curse those who hoard their grain, but they bless the one who sells in time of need. If you search for good, you will find favor. But if you search for evil, it will find you. Trust in your money and down you go. The godly flourish like leaves in spring. Then chapter 13, some who are poor pretend to be rich. Others who are rich pretend to be poor. Wealth from get-rich-quick schemes disappears quickly. Wealth from hard work grows over time. In 19, we see wealth makes many friends, but poverty drives them all away. Many seek favors from a ruler, and everyone is the friend of a person who gives gifts. If you help the poor, you are lending to the Lord, and he will repay you. In 21, good planning and hard work lead to prosperity, but hasty shortcuts lead to poverty. Wealth created by a lying tongue is a vanishing mist and a deadly trap. The wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get. Choose from 22, chapter 22. Choose a good reputation over great riches. Being held in high esteem is better than silver or gold. The rich and poor have this in common. The Lord made them both. And just as the rich rule the poor, so the borrower is servant to the lender. Blessed are those who are generous because they feed the poor. In 24, we see, I walked by the field of a lazy person, the vineyard of one with no common sense. I saw that it was overgrown with nettles. It was covered with weeds and its walls were broken down. Then as I looked and thought about it, I learned this lesson. A little extra sleep, a little more slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Then poverty will pounce on you like a bandit. Scarcity will attack you like an armed robber. Finally, from chapter 30, O God, I beg two favors from you. Let me have them before I die. First, help me never to tell a lie. Second, give me neither poverty nor riches. Give me just enough to satisfy my needs. For if I grow rich, I may deny you and say, who is the Lord? And if I am too poor, I may steal and thus insult God's holy name. That last one, Proverbs 37-9, is particularly interesting, since it actually directly addresses the earlier comment made by one of our members, that money can feel stressful whether you have too little or have excess. And we see the writer of Proverbs is also asking for just the right amount, counting such a request as equal to never telling a lie. And this is by no means an exhaustive list of the Proverbs that talk about money. It is generally unlikely that you can get through even one chapter of Proverbs without some sort of direct or indirect reference to finances. And it isn't just Proverbs that discusses money openly. The whole of the Bible covers it frequently. Indeed, when we look at the Gospels, we see Jesus talking about money all the time. In fact, whether directly as finances on the face or as part of an allegory for a different topic, nearly half of his teachings were about money. And I think this leads to an important idea. When we sit in church in a Christ-centered community, but we fail to ever discuss finances with one another, we actually fall out of line with our spiritual heritage. When you are a disciple of someone, you will talk about what they talked about. And what Jesus talked about included money, often. Now, I do want to note that in our culture that avoids this topic of money, I think there is one exception, and that is when someone is showing off. I think social media has generally amplified this effect, but it does seem like people don't talk about money until they want to tell you just how incredible their expensive new widget is. Or they want to flaunt having gone to some fancy restaurant or having landed some high-paying job. From the passages in Proverbs, a key observation is that they are never bragging. Instead, if anything, flaunting your money seems to be looked down on. I think Proverbs 22:1-2 speaks to this when it says, "Choose a good reputation over great riches. Being held in high esteem is better than silver or gold. The rich and poor have this in common. The Lord made them both." It seems that showing off your wealth is not one of the reasons for a wise person to talk about money. All right, so we've taken a good amount of time to see that the wise person does not shy away from the topic of money, including wealth and poverty. But it's less clear of why that might be the case. What is it about a wise person that permits them to have these conversations, which are often personal and hard, seemingly easily? And we're not going to answer that right now. Keep it in mind, and we're going to come back to it. So, since we've established that Proverbs doesn't shy away from discussing money, the next seemingly obvious question is, but what is it actually saying about it? Well, one of the first things Proverbs talks about is that the wise person saves some of their money while the fool spends everything. Listen to these verses. In 13:11, wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it. From 21:17-20, those who love pleasure become poor. Those who love wine and luxury will never be rich. The wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get. Proverbs tells us that we ought to save by saying that whoever gathers little by little will increase wealth. And while I suspect this idea of saving is something that many, if not all of us, have heard before, the details are often excluded. So I think it's worth expanding on what it actually means to save. Fundamentally, saving is the disposition of money or resources in which they have been set aside for future use. Saving repeated over long periods of time builds wealth. Saving is not, in and of itself, spending less. I'm going to tangent a little bit here, but this is like a bit of a pet peeve of mine, where people claim that because they spent less, they have saved the money. And honestly, businesses are very keen to put this on receipts all the time to boost our self-esteem. But if the outcome of saving $20 here and $20 there is that you go out and spend another $40, you haven't saved anything. You've just ended up with more stuff for your spending. So, even knowing what saving is, the phrase save your money has got to be at the top of the list for things that are easier said than done. Like, honestly, Garrison could easily say that, but he definitely does not know how to do it. And I think for many of us, we want to know, if I'm struggling to save, what is something practical I can do? And so here's a part where we come to our first group of specific practical ideas and applications. These are all principles and practices Vi and I have seen work well in our life, and ones that I've heard regularly repeated from multiple voices in the personal finance space, and that seem to align well with Proverbs. Practical idea number one, create and regularly engage with a budget and expense tracking to prevent the margin you may have from leaking out. Second, consider ways to increase the margin in your budget, where margin here means the difference from what you make each month versus what you spend. So if, for example, you brought in $2,800 each month and your necessary expenses are $2,600 of that, then you have $200 of margin. If, on the other hand, you were bringing in $4,000 a month, but we're regularly spending $4,000 or even more, then you don't have any margin, and you will not find it possible to save consistently. I'll add in sort of a bonus one here. One of the best ways to create margin is to aggressively review recurring expenses and try to figure out if there's anything that can be done to reduce them. My third tip is to automate your savings. Once you know how much margin you have, set up some sort of recurring transfer from your main spending account to somewhere else designated for saving or investing. If you're someone who is prone to spending everything you make, then set this to occur very close to when money comes in so that it helps force the discipline to protect that margin. So, three practical tips. Create and use a budget, increase your margin, and automate your savings. Now, on the note of spending, Proverbs is also clear that spending money is the contrast to saving it. And indeed, if you are easily enticed by stuff and experiences, you will find it is nearly impossible to earn enough money to keep up with your spending, and therefore you will never have the margin needed to really save. After all, those who love wine and luxury will never be rich. And I really want to highlight this idea because I think it's easy to say, but hard to internalize, that the wealth you build is not inseparably tied to the income that you make. It takes serious consideration to come to terms with this. And something that I've seen recently that helped me understand it was a recent study done by Goldman Sachs. In this study, they asked participants to describe their financial situation as fitting one of three descriptions. Option one was, I find it tough to make progress on any long-term financial goals. This was called living paycheck to paycheck. Option two, I am able to make some saving progress each year, termed moderately better. And I am able to make progress on both short-term and long-term financial goals, called considerably better than paycheck to paycheck. So after asking all the respondents this question, they analyzed the data and grouped them by income. Here's a chart of what that data looks like. So, chart you're looking at, we've got four kind of horizontal bars going across. These are the different income groups that they split people up into, with the lowest at the top and then highest towards the bottom. And then sort of how they answered this question about people's financial situation is represented by the color of the bars. So now, at first glance, this doesn't look surprising, and it perhaps even doesn't support what I was just saying. People who make more money don't live paycheck to paycheck as frequently. Shocking. But wait, you might notice there are a couple groups, the highest income folks, in fact, who are not up there. Let's go to the next slide and see how they are doing. That doesn't follow the trend, does it? What is happening up there? I don't have the specific numbers up there, But this is saying that fully 40% of people making over $300,000 a year are living paycheck to paycheck. And the group making over $500,000 a year appear to be doing no better than the group between 50 and 100,000. This hints at a couple things to me. First, that there are some fools who make a whole lot of money. After all, the wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get and end up living paycheck to paycheck. Now, this proverb doesn't say that the fool might not get a lot, but it's clear that they do not save any of what they get. And second, I think this highlights that there's a real difference between wealth and income. I've been a little loose with my terms so far, but I want to highlight this key difference. Income is the money you make. Wealth is the money you have. I think this also relates to a common proverb in American pop culture, which, fun fact, actually predates America by a good amount. But you cannot have your cake and eat it too. Or as I prefer to say it, you cannot eat your cake and have it too. That was the original way it was presented. Once you have eaten the cake, you no longer have it. The same is true with money. You cannot spend your money and have it too. And it's the having of money, not the spending, that equates to wealth. I think this distinction between wealth and income is also hinted at in Proverbs 13:7, when it says, "Some who are poor pretend to be rich. These are the people who make $500,000 a year and spend it all. Others who are rich pretend to be poor. These are those who make more modest incomes, but yet save it consistently and become wealthy." Now, however, I'd say besides that one example, it felt like a lot of the biblical proverbs didn't specifically mention income and rather focus on wealth and poverty. And I think this is because both the fool and the wise may have a low income or a high income. But it is only the wise who is able to save consistently over time so that they build wealth, as opposed to always ending up living paycheck to paycheck. So, having established the very real tension that we have between saving and spending, I want to further discuss the heart posture that can help reduce spending to increase saving. When data like 40% of people making more than 500K are living paycheck to paycheck is shared online, I've noticed that many personal finance folks say something to the effect of, "We must have a discipline problem if people making that much money live paycheck to paycheck." And perhaps that is true. But I think there's a more fundamental issue, and that is that we have a contentment problem. Contentment is the opposite of envy and covetousness. Someone who is content will naturally not spend their money and will easily be able to save money because they don't want more. Of course, discipline may also result in being able to save money, but it has to be constantly applied to be effective. Since any lapse in discipline can blow up your budget as you give in to the underlying want. On the other hand, pursuing contentment addresses that underlying desire for the spending. And so even when your discipline fails, you are unlikely to suddenly overspend because you are content with what you have. Now, contentment is not easy in our culture. Because our culture is not a naturally content one. We are constantly told to go get more, that we need the bigger house, that we deserve the nicer car, and that we have to treat ourselves first when something good happens or when something bad happens. But, yeah, that's all the time, right? But these are beliefs, not facts. And they are beliefs that are not true, and they run contrary to the wisdom of God. I want to say that again. These are beliefs, the idea that we need a bigger house, a nicer car, that we should always treat ourselves when good or bad or whatever happens. They are beliefs. They are not facts. And that they are beliefs that are not true and that run contrary to the wisdom of God. I do want to give a quick note here regarding debt. There are certain circles in which debt gets a lot of the focus around finances. And while I think that can be warranted, I also know that it wouldn't be relevant to everyone here, so I'm going to keep it short and have two just high-level notes on debt. One, nearly always when debt becomes a problem, it is a symptom of out-of-control spending or a lack of savings. And two, as such, Proverbs clearly suggests that staying out of debt is good. 22:7 says, "Just as the rich rule the poor, so the borrower is servant to the lender." So, Proverbs is highlighting that the wise should save. And we've thought about how saving is a natural opposite of spending. Then, we considered how contentment helps us to resist the culture of spending we find ourselves in. But one obvious question remaining is, for what purpose are we to save? Getting practical again, I think there are at least three categories that the Bible supports for saving. Firstly, we save for when the reality of a broken world intersects with our finances. Often we call this an emergency fund. It is money set aside that is only to be touched when something goes truly wrong. An unexpected trip to the hospital, a layoff just when you thought work was going well, or the roads of Tucson deciding that the suspension in your car would look way better on the side of the road. Kind of a true story. These things will never be enjoyable, but having that emergency fund set aside can prevent them from being truly catastrophic. Next, we save for expected large purchases. These are often called sinking funds, and it is a way to pay for things outright that don't happen often, but you know you need eventually. A replacement car, a restful vacation, or a large home repair are great examples of things to use sinking funds for. The simplest way to do this is to figure out how much the item will cost, when you'll need to spend that money. Just divide that total cost by the months remaining, and you'll know how much you need to save each month for that purchase. I think this practice of sinking funds aligns well with the teaching of Jesus from Luke 14, where he says, "But don't begin until you count the cost. For who would begin construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there is enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money, and then everyone would laugh at you. They would say, 'There's the person who started that building and couldn't afford to finish it.' Have a sinking fund before breaking ground to avoid half-finished buildings." The last clear reason for saving is to provide for yourself and any dependents in your old age. Today, this is often phrased as saving for retirement, but ultimately the idea is this, that there will almost certainly come a day when you are no longer able or no longer interested in working for a paycheck. And at that point, having savings and investments will allow you to continue to provide for your needs without placing financial burden on those around you. Proverbs is also clear of one reason that we should not, that should not be the motivation for saving. We do not save in order to become rich. Proverbs 23:4-5 says it this way: "Don't wear yourself out trying to get rich. Be wise enough to know when to quit. In the blink of an eye, wealth disappears. It will sprout wings and fly away like an eagle." So, these practical tips are good, and they've certainly helped me. But implementing them may require some serious behavior and mindset changes. And I think it leaves us asking, is this knowledge really enough to change our behavior around saving? Can we gain the contentment we need simply by understanding the principles of a budget? To me, it seems that we're still missing an adequate motivation. Perhaps we'll find it the next thing you can do with money. Having covered saving and spending, we're now going to cover what I think is the third major thing you can do with your money, and that is giving. And I think this is a topic that in many ways can be divisive or easily misunderstood in Christian financial teaching. And honestly, I will not be able to cover all aspects of it today. It warrants an even greater deep dive. But to try and understand the basics, let's look again at Proverbs 11:24-28. "Give freely and become more wealthy. Be stingy and lose everything. The generous will prosper. Those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed. People curse those who hoard their grain, but they bless the one who sells in time of need. If you search for food, you will find search for good, you will find favor. But if you search for evil, it will find you. Trust in your money and down you go. but the godly flourish like leaves in spring. And then in Proverbs 19:17, if you help the poor, you are lending to the Lord, and he will repay you. These passages prompt the question, does giving away money cause you to have more money? Now, this, of course, doesn't make any numeric sense. And yet, it seems to be what the Proverbs are saying. And it's something Vi and I have found play out that way in our lives. As we have learned to be more generous, it sure seems like God continues and expands his blessing to us. And something else that stands out to me is that most of the personal finance folks I follow online recommend giving, even when they have a clearly secular perspective. I think this is good evidence that these principles, though counterintuitive, do hold true and are found to be effective even by those who may not understand God's mechanisms for them. In addition to seeing Proverbs 11:24 seem to play out in our real lives, we've also found that between spending, saving, and giving, the most fun you can have with money is to give it away, especially when that giving is done with a generous heart and for the benefit of others. Now, I think this is sort of an important hard candy moment in Proverbs, because I do want to highlight that there is a way in which taking this out of context can go wrong, these principles of generosity, which is to acknowledge that there has been more than one large and successful religious organization which has effectively misused verses like Proverbs 11:24 to try and claim that you can gain guaranteed wealth if only you'll give your gift of faith to their organization. This often gets termed the prosperity gospel, and it is ultimately fueled by greed of the leaders and praise on covetousness of the participants. It treats God like a sort of vending machine deity, where if you are willing to give more, then God becomes obliged to enrich you because of your gifts. And unfortunately, it ignores the reality that God looks at the heart, and he rejects attempts to manipulate his generosity for personal gain. Now, I also want to talk about a resource that has actually had a huge impact on my views around giving, including some of how I'm phrasing tonight's sermon, which is this video from the Bible Project. It's a podcast-style video titled, Does a Good Christian Tithe 10%? It's not that simple. It tells a powerful story about what happened when two very successful young men began to ask, what does the Bible actually say about giving for those of us living under the new covenant? And honestly, if I get you to take only one action out of this sermon, it would probably be to go and listen to that video. It's that good. It is an hour long, so we don't got any time for it tonight, but go listen to it. It's really, really good. I think another reason that Proverbs states forgiving is to avoid hoarding. In many cases, the difference between saving and hoarding is giving. Hoarding reflects a condition of the human heart that has turned inwards towards self instead of being turned towards others and God. Therefore, the people of God are actually called to work against that tendency of hoarding by giving away generously out of our excess. While I'm referring to this in the abstract, I think it's important to acknowledge that one place we are consistently directed to give is towards our local church. So for most in the room, that likely means giving towards mission, which raises the question, when we give to mission, what are we actually giving to? One of the things I really like about us is that we put up our annual budget to be available for folks who want to look at it. It is sitting back by the giving table, sitting back on that giving table, and so you can see exactly what it is that we have, that we're bringing in, and that we're planning to budget out to others, and how we plan to budget and spend it. A lot of it goes towards paying the staff that are here and towards maintaining the building. I also think it's really cool the way in which the process for making that budget works. probably could talk to you about that more another time, but in particular this year, we were excited to be able to increase the amount that we get to give out to other organizations beyond mission, either missionaries who have come directly from our community or the missions organizations of denomination that we are involved in, things like that. So I think one of the practical section on giving, there's the question of how much should I give? And this is a hard question to answer because the most honest answer is it depends. But I think there are a few key guidelines. And the first is that though the answer to how much should I give may vary from person to person, the answer is never none. We are always asked to give something to God. And second, whatever the amount given is, it should entail some sort of sacrifice. We find these principles highlighted clearly in the story of the widow's offering from Mark 12, where Jesus makes it clear that a poorer widow offering the last two pennies she had was considered as having given more than many others who were bringing large sums, because they gave only a small percent of their surplus. With God, it's never about the total amount given. It's always about the heart that you have towards it. And regarding the principle that it should include some sacrifice, I think we get a feel for this by considering the reality that God in the Old Testament asked for the first tenth of his people's produce. In an agrarian society, this is a high ask because it means that after your year of planting and growing, reaping your harvest, you then store that harvest throughout the year. And you do not have new food that comes in until after winter and after planting and after growing and reaping again. And when God asks for a tenth, he asks for that first tenth. This means that for those people, a dramatic trust would have to be placed in God because they would be relying on him to make last year's harvest last that one bit longer. For me personally, that sacrifice is the car. At the start, I mentioned being known for Hawaiian shirts and interest in personal finance, but something perhaps less known about me is that I'm a huge car enthusiast. I have an interest in all sorts of sporty, fast cars since before I knew how to drive. And to this day, could quote you all sorts of facts about these cars. Despite this, you may know that my current vehicles cannot really be described that way. I have a full-size sedan and an electric crossover. This is a purposeful choice that I've made to step back from the type of car I'd like to have for the sake of freeing up the money that sports cars take so that we can give more generously. All right, so we've given some of the basics around giving, what Proverbs is saying and some of what it is not saying. But all this framing still feels a bit off, don't you think? We've approached giving from the perspective of what might I get from it, whether blessing from God or the joy of giving, or how many of my resources need to be given to God. But those are at best incomplete motivations for sacrificial giving, and at worst, they'll result in completely misguided giving. So, now I know we've covered some ground, and perhaps you've noticed that open questions are starting to accumulate. It seems like these areas of giving, saving, and just talking about money have some common ground of simple principles that are very difficult to follow. I think this is where the last section of our sermon will have something to say, but before that, it is time for Learning Nerdy Things with Garrett, the recurring section of my sermons in which I talk about something I find super interesting and think more people should know about, and that usually has at least some connection to the sermon. So today, we're talking about exponential growth in the context of compound interest. All right, that's a cheer for compound interest. I'm even more excited. All right, sometimes called the eighth wonder of the world, compounding interest is one of the few places that the average person can really participate in exponential growth. So, let's go ahead and take a sort of financial example here. Let's assume that you can save $100 per month. If you simply save that money for 20 years, you would end up with $24,000. But if instead you invest it to earn a return and you allow that return to stay invested so that your return earns a return and so on, you'll instead have a little over $75,600. And this slide kind of gives away the big numbers. But if you bump that up to 30 years, that has jumped up to $217,000. And again, this is still just $100 a month. How about a full working career of 40 years? You have now contributed $48,000, but you'll have $584,000. That means 92% of the money you have has come from the compounding growth. Now, what if we go all the way out to 50 years? Jumps up to $1,536,000, the last big bar on the right. So that means that if you are hearing this and you're maybe in your early 20s or even still a teenager, looking at you Ponce kids, congratulations, you have just found out how to be a millionaire. And it only takes $100 a month. And lastly, just for kicks and giggles, what if you somehow invested $100 a month for your entire life? Let's call that 80 years. Now they already got it up there. That goes all the way up to $27 million. Is there anything else there? All right. So hopefully you have enjoyed Nerdy Time with Garrett and now have a greater appreciation for the impact of compounding interest. Coming back to the sermon, right now we have at least three open questions that need some sort of resolution. We started off by inquiring why it is that talking about our finances enough or in the right ways or at the right times is so challenging. Then we observed that the wise person is to be a saver, but also noticed that on our own we have a propensity to overspend. How is it that I'm really supposed to learn contentment in order to save more effectively? And finally, we recognized the need to be a giver, but it remained unclear how we do that without trying to show off or get something back from God in return. In order to make sense of all these challenging questions, we need to take a step back and remind ourselves what it is that underpins the whole book of Proverbs, which is that wisdom is a key characteristic of God, and that therefore the godly will heed the call of wisdom and reject the alluring voice of folly. Some of these are terms that we've used throughout our series this year. Thus, the wise person gains wisdom by knowing the true character of God and responding to that appropriately. One such response is seen in Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and fools despise wisdom and instruction. The key attribute of God that I want to highlight here is common in Old Testament passages and is what we need to consider, that God is trustworthy. In Exodus 34:6, the Lord passed in front of Moses calling out, "Yahweh, the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy, I am slow to anger and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness." While all of the attributes in this list are deeply informative of who God is, I want to highlight that final one, faithfulness. It is the Hebrew word emet, which indeed means being faithful, but is also tied to the idea of truth. Not just truth that is correct, but truth that is stable, sturdy, unchanging, like a rock. A solid rock could reasonably be described as emet. And therefore, when used to describe people, it represents someone who is reliable and who you can count on, someone who is trustworthy. To say that God is full of emet means that God is stable and reliable, not just to the truth, but also to the rest of his character, and is therefore to be viewed as most trustworthy. So that's key idea number one. God is trustworthy. A second key element that we need to know about who God is comes most clearly from a passage in another source of ancient wisdom and poetry, the book of Psalms. In Psalm 50, God speaking says, "I do not need the bulls from your barns or the goats from your pens, for all the animals of the forest are mine, and I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know every bird on the mountains, and all the animals of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for all the world is mine and everything in it." And when it's talking about things God does not need from us, the bulls from our barns and the goats from your pens, I think it could easily be rephrased in today's verbiage to include, or the checks from your books, which is probably still too old school for some of my audience. So maybe we could also add, or the tap from your card. God makes the main idea from this passage clear. Everything belongs to him. He does not need our giving to be sustained. He is already the Lord of it all. We see a similar principle from Proverbs 18:10-11. The name of the Lord is a strong fortress. The godly run to him and are safe. The rich think of their wealth as a strong defense. They imagine it to be a high wall of safety. Here we can see the safety the Lord provides is greater and more than any that could be provided from wealth. I think this ties into one of the common words we use in Christian circles when finances come up, without really considering the meaning: stewardship. Stewardship comes from medieval times, where a steward was appointed by a king or a lord to manage their property on their behalf. That property that they managed was never theirs. It remained the lord's or the king's. They were to do a good job managing it, and they were to manage it in a way consistent with the character of the lord for whom they managed it. I think it is right that God has called us to be stewards of creation. We are here to manage it. The stuff that we have is under our management, but it remains God's because he has made us stewards, not owners. And so that is the second key idea. Everything, all of it, is owned by God. So now, with those two ideas in mind, that God is most trustworthy and that everything is his already, let's look back through our open questions. When it comes to giving, we were asking, how much should I give and how do I give sacrificially? But how much should I give is the wrong question to ask. When instead you approach it from the perspective that everything belongs to God, the question should be better phrased as, how much do I really need to keep, since it's all God's anyway? We can lean in to being fully generous because we know that God is Lord over it all, that he is trustworthy to care for us, his children. And so when it comes to sacrificial giving, I'll put forward this sort of application challenge. How much effort do you put into planning and figuring out how many of the resources under your management you can give away, either back to God or to others? This week or this month, take just a little bit more time and a little bit more effort into thinking how you could give away a little bit more. Regarding saving, we've already noted that contentment is countercultural, and you must have something stronger to hold on to in order to resist the idols of consumerism and materialism. That something stronger is the character of God, including his trustworthiness and his love toward us. If he is king of all, and he is, then we can be content with what we have and choose to wisely and faithfully save the difference. And when it comes to talking about our finances, a trust in God is powerful to diffuse the shame you might feel of not having your finances where you'd like them to be. And acknowledging God as owner defeats the pride in our finances, since what are you proud about? None of it is yours anyway. You're just the manager. And so on this topic, I also have a specific challenge for everyone here. Sometime this week, find time with at least one person who knows you well to talk about money. Talk about your current emotions or situation, whatever really. But talk about God's money that he's given to you and how you're managing it. And while I'm the one up here giving the sermon, everything said today is just as much for me as it is for you. Going into this week, I was feeling very down on myself around my own handling of money and my challenges in creating a structured sermon about it. And as you've seen, I've definitely blown our time a little bit. But it turns out that God was working in my life this week. He was reminding me that whether I have a little or a lot, it's all his, and I'm just to be a steward of what he's given to me. He was reminding me that no amount of money can grant a level of security that exceeds or really even rivals what can be found by placing my trust in him as the most trustworthy. And finally, he was reminding me that the first place to go for wisdom is his character. That even when I fall short of wisdom in my finances, and I have, and I do, and I probably will in the future, that he is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And when I focus on that, the wise way to handle finances is likely to come along as a pleasant side effect. Now, we're going to move into our final three rhythms of worship, which are confess, receive, and offer. For confession, we'll have 2 minutes of silence to just talk to God. It's an opportunity to confess whatever we're feeling. It could be sin, questions, even a confession of faith. It might be a great time to confess about how we've handled our finances, maybe mistakes we've made or hard-heartedness and generosity or a mindset that is self-centered instead of God-centered. The good news is that God already knows these things, and through Jesus, he is faithful and just to forgive. After the time of silence, there will be a time of singing and musical worship where we will confess our faith, hope, and love towards God. And we will also receive, remembering that we come empty-handed to Jesus. In him, we have been given life, grace, acceptance, purpose, and money. We receive these through the songs and especially through the table, which I'll come back to. And then offer. In worship, we offer ourselves to him, our praises, and our gifts. We also offer the work of our hands and our hearts. In the back there, there's the giving station, the setup iPad and the giving box. There's also a window. If there is a place in your life where you feel that you have not, where you feel the Spirit convicting you in your handling of God's money, that'd be a great thing to write a word or two on that window to represent that to you. Feel free to write over the other things that are there. Our goal is at the end of the year, it's going to be all filled up and all sorts of stuff from all the weeks that we've had it up. Now, table. So part of receive is coming to the communion table. The communion table is where we acknowledge that Jesus is ultimately the one that we are looking to, that he is the one who has, like, paid it all, right? That we, in the money sense, that we were debtors with a debt that we could never repay, but that Christ came and paid that debt on our behalf, and that we are now free because of his payment and his sacrifice. So we'll come up. During the singing, we'll kind of line up, and we'll receive it. I'll serve it to you. We've got bread and wine juice. So, all right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and pray for us, and then we'll leave 2 minutes for confession. Let's pray. Jesus, I thank you for your words of wisdom. I thank you that you are God's wisdom come to earth. I thank you that in the area of money, you did not leave us without guidance, without your words, without insight into how you view money, into the ways in which finances work within your kingdom, and how they can be used to work for your glory. I pray during this time of confession that we would just be reminded that regardless of where we are at or what we have done, that you are a gracious and merciful God who comes to us and offers us yourself as the payment for our debts, and that we can rest on that above and beyond any particulars or specifics that we may feel around our finances.